This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Proof of Collusion, How Trump Betrayed America, by Seth Abramson, read by Robert Petkoff.
To all the public defenders, Mr. Trump's claims of no collusion are, in a word, hogwash. Former CIA Director John Brennan, August 16, 2018. Introduction. A Theory of the Case. The Trump-Russia investigation may be the most multifaceted, wide-ranging, high-stakes federal criminal investigation in American history. It crosses continents and decades and has swept into its vortex more than 400 people, millions of pages of financial records, and scores of unanswered questions about the state of our democracy. It has already resulted in dozens of indictments and a host of guilty pleas and prison sentences. If President Trump colluded with Kremlin agents to secure his election or to benefit his real estate empire down the road, or if he knows that any of his associates did so, it gives the Kremlin leverage over him in a way that endangers our national security and even our national sovereignty. Whatever your political views and whatever your opinion of Donald Trump, you have a vested interest in finding out the truth about Trump-Russia collusion if you want America to be governed by the consent of the people and not the Kremlin. In view of all this, you may be surprised to learn that, as a legal term, collusion is meaningless outside antitrust law. In lay terms, collusion is simply a clandestine agreement between two or more parties, implicit or explicit, to act in a mutually beneficial way. That collusion is always clandestine underscores that it is almost always a transgression, no matter the venue or the participants. That certain acts of collusion can violate criminal statutes means that collusive behavior is sometimes criminal behavior as well. The notion of an American politician colluding with a foreign power, let alone a hostile one, is antithetical to our values and has been since the nation declared its independence in 1776. Because foreign nationals are not permitted by U.S. law to interfere in our elections, foreign governments generally refrain from commenting on our electoral processes and certainly do not seek to contribute money or other benefits to our candidates. Doing so is a federal crime. In the few instances in which politicians have been caught receiving money or in-kind contributions from foreign entities, it's been regarded as a rare scandal. Should it also be discovered that the politician and his staff reached out to that foreign entity with the aim of securing a hard money or in-kind contribution, the scandal would become generationally significant. And should that politician be running for president, and should the nation he sought contributions from be a hostile foreign power that was waging cyber war on America's critical infrastructure, that generationally significant scandal would become unprecedented. In short, it is likely that the Trump-Russia story ends with Americans choosing a new archetype for American traitor besides Benedict Arnold. Proof of collusion in the Trump-Russia case is in plain sight. When the president or his allies say there was no collusion, what they mean is that the type of collusion the president undoubtedly engaged in does not constitute a criminal offense, whether or not it constitutes an impeachable one. This latter distinction is important. Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani has taken great pains in the latter half of 2018 to say that the Trump-Russia case is predominantly a political one, and to the extent most legal scholars believe a sitting president can't be indicted, he is correct. The House of Representatives has to vote to bring charges against a president, and the Senate has to preside over his trial and find him guilty. In this current climate, there is a chance that may not happen. That said, it so happens that much of this president's collusion may in fact be criminal. The particular forms of collusion in which Trump, members of his family who are also political advisors, and his presidential campaign engaged may include aiding and abetting or conspiracy connected to electoral fraud, computer crimes, bribery, and money laundering, as well as acts of witness tampering, making false statements, obstruction of justice, and much more. Conspiracy occurs when two or more persons have a meeting of the minds and set as their ambition the commission of a criminal act. The federal conspiracy statute is violated when the parties take an act in furtherance of the commission of the intended crime. But the crime does not have to be committed for a violation of the conspiracy statute to be found. In America's system of justice, those designated to prosecute a case are obligated by the rules of professional ethics to be relentlessly zealous advocates for their position. The system doesn't work otherwise. Without zealous advocates, we might as well adopt the so-called inquisitorial system of justice employed in most of Europe's courtrooms rather than the adversarial system we have here in America. To an outside observer, zealous advocacy often looks like radicalism. In fact, it's a civic duty for trial advocates, and one that's emotionally and intellectually exhausting to fulfill. That's certainly the case with my ongoing public accounting of the Trump-Russia investigation, though the work is made easier, I'll confess, by the almost historic absence, I say this advisedly, of any exculpatory evidence suggesting the President of the United States did not conspire with our enemies to violate federal law. I make that statement not as a political partisan, but as an American citizen and legal professional who, for many years, pored over thousands of police reports, witness statements, lab results, and documentary and photographic evidence, looking for any trace of information that could exculpate my clients. I am trained by years of experience and habit to search for an alternative explanation besides the obvious one. That the defendant is indeed a criminal, responsible for either the charges as leveled against him, or some lesser offense included in or ancillary to the ones he's currently facing. That roughly 95% of defendants in criminal cases in America accept responsibility for their actions and enter a guilty plea in exchange for a fair punishment is at times a testament to law enforcement and at times an indictment of our ability to give defendants the resources to adequately defend themselves. Most commonly, though, it denotes a body of evidence that is overwhelmingly inculpatory. It's within this framework of experience, principle, and philosophy that I say that I have never before encountered a criminal investigation in which the entirety of the evidence is as damning as it is in the Trump-Russia investigation. From a professional rather than partisan perspective, the conclusion of the Trump-Russia scandal is all but certain. An untold number of indictments, prison sentences, and dispiriting revelations about public figures, all of which will momentarily cast doubt on our ability to move forward as a functioning democracy. That the evidence against Trump and his associates is so thoroughly in one direction makes it all the more startling that there has yet to be any published defense of Trump or his allies on the facts whose contentions would be taken seriously in a court of law. I'm as surprised by that fact as anyone, especially given who the defendant is here and what is so conspicuously at stake in the investigation. As a longtime criminal defense attorney, I have long sympathized most, philosophically at least, with the role of defense counsel in our adversarial system of justice. Defense teams are commonly under-resourced, outgunned by a state or federal apparatus with a built-in investigatory arm, a judiciary systematically tilted toward the needs and values of the government, and well-trained prosecutors who are ruthlessly ambitious, if not always efficient. But Donald Trump is a different type of defendant. His defense team is a different sort of defense team, and the defense he and his team have mounted so far is not recognizable to an attorney as any sort of legal defense at all. From his Twitter feed, Trump launches daily baseless ad hominem attacks against prosecutors, investigators, and witnesses alike, and he does so with a seeming impunity from the allegations of witness tampering and obstruction of justice that any of my clients at public defender offices in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, or D.C. would have faced had they behaved similarly. His attorneys daily play semantic games that don't so much advance their clients' interests as function as a pervasive campaign to misinform Americans about how our system of justice works and why. For instance, their contention that collusion is not a crime goes beyond mere rhetoric and into a profoundly unethical misrepresentation of the real state of affairs. Within the umbrella term collusion, there are dozens of federal criminal statutes that federal law enforcement can and does routinely enforce. As for the broader defense strategy Trump and his attorneys have fashioned against his critics, the strategy seems to be a political, not a legal one. Every time I see Giuliani or Jay Sekulow on television implying, if not outright alleging, a deep state conspiracy to frame this president, I do not see a fellow brother at the bar, but a high-priced political operator. While several chapters of this book contain original reporting, the bulk of Proof of Collusion aggregates and curates information rather than reporting it. The book is a compilation, at times in summary form and at times in minute detail, of not just the evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign, now administration, and Russian nationals, but also of the criminality born of that collusion. The book's subchapters are drawn from major media news stories linked to on my Twitter feed since January 2017, and supplementary news stories and factual updates supporting and expanding upon the materials available on my feed. Taken in sum, these articles and analyses compose the current state of affairs in the Trump-Russia investigation, at least that part of the investigation that is open to public view. My hope is that listeners will not only benefit from this presentation, but also find many opportunities to discover new connections within the curated pieces of evidence. An accounting of this evidence is made necessary not just by the frenetic pace of Trump-Russia news and the gravity of the investigation behind it, but the fact that Americans are likely to remain in the dark for months. What originally was 6 investigations in Congress, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, the House Judiciary Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime and Terrorism, is now just one. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The other investigations have either been shut down or turned their attention toward harassing, impeaching, and in some cases even seeking criminal charges against the law enforcement officials and U.S. intelligence partners who have been, and in many cases still are, investigating the president and his team. While a separate congressional investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, better classified as a hot cyber war than interference, is ongoing, it has yet to lead to new election safeguards by the Trump administration or to new funding for election security. Meanwhile, the one professional, nonpartisan investigation of Trump-Russia ties conducted by Special Counsel Robert Mueller at the Justice Department is at once virtually leak-free and under constant assault and threat of termination by Trump, his allies in Congress, and his advocates in the media. The result of all this chaos is that Americans are either misled by partisan evidentiary summaries released by Trump allies in Congress, disheartened by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and its lack of progress and odd unwillingness to subpoena critical witnesses, or bewildered by the lack of information forthcoming from the Office of the Special Counsel under the direction of the Department of Justice. Every few weeks or months, a new indictment or plea hits the news, or a leak from the White House by an attention-seeking staffer gives the public some insight into what might be going on behind the scenes. But it's never enough. Nothing ever seems to get resolved. This is the state of America in 2018. We wait for news on the possibility that our president may be beholden to a foreign power, and the final verdict never arrives, despite feeling tantalizingly close. America deserves and demands an accounting of the evidence compiled by media outlets, congressional investigators, and law enforcement in advance of a final, comprehensive special counsel report that might not arrive until mid to late 2019 or even 2020. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who is currently overseeing the investigation, isn't obligated to make that report public once he receives it, though, as a fellow attorney, I certainly hope and expect he will, for the good of the nation. So the public might never get the full details of what went on between the Kremlin and Donald Trump, the Republican Party, and allies of Trump in and out of government. Proof of Collusion aims to move forward the public discussion of the most significant criminal investigation of our lives. But listeners should know that there is one type of evidence that is absent from this book entirely. Financial records. Breaking a 40-year tradition, Trump refused to release his tax returns prior to Election Day, and we've since come to learn that they will never be released. And, breaking a tradition much longer than 40 years, the U.S. Congress has refused to subpoena or otherwise force the disclosure of any financial records through any of its investigations, even though they may well hinge on the flow of money into shell corporations and hidden bank accounts. Even the Treasury Department has recently been accused of failing to turn over documents that might have informed America much sooner of suspicious transactions involving accused Russian spy Maria Butina and her boyfriend, GOP operative and NRA member Paul Erickson. Unfortunately, these are derelictions of duty and lapses of honor that no public investigation can remedy. We in the public do not have the subpoena power and can only encourage those who do to do their jobs by how we vote every 2 years and during special elections. So while the Trump-Russia investigation may end up revealing one of the most audacious money laundering schemes in the last century, perhaps involving one or more European banks or banks in Cyprus under investigation for Russian money laundering, this book cannot go there yet. That said, the investigatory model my Twitter feed and this book uses to contribute to public discussion of the Trump-Russia case relies on the development of a theory of the case, a narrative that connects all other narratives. A good theory of the case must be dynamic as well as encompassing. It must adapt as new facts emerge and must quickly supplant old presuppositions with fresh analyses. To develop a theory, a criminal investigator must first know all the facts of a case, a task that, with a fact pattern as complex and wide-ranging as that of the Trump-Russia investigation, can feel daunting or even impossible. Nevertheless, a committed investigator builds a timeline of events, a mental gallery of major witnesses and suspects, and a compendium of hard and circumstantial evidence. In doing so, the investigator is able to author a grand narrative that works in concert with, rather than against, the presently available evidence. In the case of the ongoing Trump-Russia probe, the only plausible theory of the case that coordinates with all the existing evidence is that Donald Trump and a core group of 10 to 20 aides, associates, and allies conspired with a hostile foreign power to sell that power control over America's foreign policy in exchange for financial reward and, eventually, covert election assistance. This theory doesn't contend that anyone in the president's sphere participated in any hacking or even knew about Russia's cyber intrusions in advance. It doesn't allege that the conspiracy many members of the Trump team were involved in was finely wrought, as opposed to chaotic, amateurish, and quickly capable of producing a mountain of incriminating evidence. It doesn't require that all elements of its grand narrative take place in private, as indeed many of them occurred in the plain sight of millions of Americans. And it doesn't allege that any of the actions involved rose to the level of statutory treason, a federal criminal statute that applies only if America is in a declared state of war. What this theory of the case does do is explain decades of suspicious behavior by Donald Trump, his family, and his closest associates, behavior that suggests that these bad actors expected and received a massive financial reward for taking policy positions friendly to the Kremlin and adverse to the interests of the United States. The theory further maintains that once Trump had sufficient knowledge of Russian crimes to be legally responsible for not aiding and abetting them with promises of policies unilaterally beneficial to the Kremlin, a point Trump reached on August 17, 2016 at the very latest, any additional actions taken to advance Russian interests were criminal. The theory organizes a clear and discreet roster of those Trump aides, associates, and allies who were complicit in Trump's financially motivated appeasement of a hostile foreign power. And in so doing, it explains why nearly every name on that list attaches to a Trump campaign, transition, or administration figure who has lied about his associations with Russian nationals. In a criminal investigation, even a single significant lie can signal a witness's or suspect's guilty conscience. In the Trump-Russia investigation, the combined half-truths and outright falsehoods spread by 10 to 20 Team Trump co-conspirators now number in the dozens. Right now, the inaction of congressional Republicans, a failure to prosecute those who have lied to Congress or to subpoena those who won't speak to Congress at all, enables these lies to continue. Proof of Collusion aims to provide a careful, comprehensive, and compelling presentation of the evidence supporting the only theory of the case that answers the question of what's happening in America right now and how we can stop it. Chapter 1. Russia and the Trumps, 1987 to 2012. Summary. After 15 years of financial failures in Russia, failures born not of a lack of desire to succeed, but a lack of access to the people in Russia who make wealth creation possible, the Trumps discover that the key to making a fortune in real estate in Russia is greasing the skids with influential Russian officials. When the Trumps finally learn this lesson in the early 2000s, the result is the Russian riches that the family, particularly its patriarch, Donald Trump Sr., has long sought. The family gains, too, a new set of Russian, Russian-American, and Soviet-born allies who will in time rescue the family from its business struggles in the recession of the late 2000s and early 2010s, when many U.S. banks are declining to lend to the Trump Organization. Many of these new allies have criminal histories, dubious business practices, close ties to the Kremlin, or all three. But the Trumps' many years of candor about their fondness for Russia, as well as their boasts of the money their many business ties to that nation have brought them over the years, will dissipate instantly once Donald Trump decides to run for president of the United States not long after the 2012 presidential election. The facts. Up until 1987, Donald Trump is not regarded as a particularly political public figure. However, in 1987, he publishes The Art of the Deal and takes a trip to Moscow, one or both of which send him in the direction of a political career. Trump's trip to Moscow in 1987 comes at the invitation of Russia's ambassador to the United States, Yuri Dubinin. In Moscow, Trump stays in the Lenin suite of the Hotel National, which, as Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine notes, certainly would have been bugged in 1987. Trump holds meetings on the possible construction of a Trump hotel with Soviet officials, coming away from the meetings certain that the officials are eager to do business with him. On returning to the United States, Trump spends nearly $100,000 on politically charged newspaper ads attacking American allies like Japan and Saudi Arabia for spending too little on their own defense. He urges America to tax these wealthy nations and shortly thereafter makes a high-profile trip to New Hampshire, the sort of trip that is often considered a prelude to a presidential bid. Trump's 1987 bid for a Trump hotel in Moscow falls through, according to the Washington Post, only because Trump was preoccupied with other business projects. Once Trump's companies recover from a string of bankruptcies in 1991 and 1992, he returns his attention to the Russian market. In 1996, he returns to Moscow with Howard Lorber, one of his closest friends, according to the Post. Together they scout locations for an office tower and eventually find both a location for the tower and a prospective Russian partner for the project. Trump announces plans for a Trump International branded building in November 1996. The deal will see him investing $250 million and licensing his name to two buildings. "We have an understanding we will be doing it," Trump says. At the press conference promoting the deal, he says he doesn't think he's ever been as impressed with the potential of a city as I have been with Moscow. However, Trump has a problem. American banks will no longer lend to him, citing his track record for paying back only pennies on the dollar, what the banks call the Donald risk. By 1997, though no construction has begun on Trump's hoped-for Moscow projects, the New Yorker is writing of the breadth of Trump's hopes for Moscow investment and business connections. Trump's plans for the expansion of his real estate portfolio into Russia go well beyond a single Trump International hotel. Trump envisions a much larger series of investments. He tells the New Yorker, "It would be skyscrapers and hotels. We're working with the local government, the mayor of Moscow, and the mayor's people. So far, they've been very responsive." As Trump's 1996 plans finally fall through for good, Russia begins a period of political upheaval that sees the nation led by five successive prime ministers appointed by Boris Yeltsin over a 15-month period in 1998 and 1999. The last of these prime ministers is a man by the name of Vladimir Putin. Putin, the former first deputy chairman, the equivalent of a deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, develops a fondness for Miss St. Petersburg, Oksana Fyodorova, sometime before she is crowned Miss Russia in 2001. It is widely known that he has a picture of her in his office. After Fyodorova wins the 2001 Miss Russia pageant, rumors abound, spurred in part by the presence of Putin's domestic intelligence service, the FSB, acting as security at the competition, that the pageant has been rigged so that Fyodorova will win. Local media say that either the pageant was corrupt or its organizers knew instinctively it would be unwise, not politically correct, according to the Telegraph, to let anyone but Fyodorova win. In winning the Miss Russia pageant, Fyodorova becomes Russia's entrant to the 2002 Miss Universe pageant, an international competition owned by Donald Trump. Though the 2002 pageant is scheduled to take place in Puerto Rico, anticipation for the event is high in Russia because of Putin's admiration for Fyodorova and because no Russian woman has ever won the Miss Universe pageant in its then half-century of continuous operation. At the time of the 2002 Miss Universe pageant, Fyodorova's publicly acknowledged boyfriend is Vladimir Golubev, a St. Petersburg crime boss heavily involved in the construction industry. But the scuttlebutt in Moscow is that Fyodorova is actually with a different Vladimir. A May 2002 article published immediately after the 2002 Miss Universe pageant calls Fyodorova Putin's girl. There is substantial press attention on the pageant in Moscow as Fyodorova wins the competition and makes pageant history as the first Miss Universe from Russia. On November 2, 2017, an eyewitness to the judging process at the 2002 Miss Universe contest will contact this author to say that the contest was rigged. After the eyewitness's identity has been verified, the eyewitness recounts the following. "After there are only 10 contestants left in the 2002 Miss Universe pageant, an elimination process that Trump directly participates in at this point in the pageant's history, Trump addresses the pageant's celebrity judges and indicates that he wants Miss Russia crowned Miss Universe. The source reports Trump saying, 'There's definitely clearly one woman out there who's head and shoulders above the rest. She's the one I'd vote for. Given the context of the statement, Trump issuing his formal instructions to the judges as they prepared for the conclusion of the pageant, as well as his demeanor while speaking, the eyewitness asserts that Trump told the judges who to vote for, adding that a subsequent conversation among the celebrity judges revealed that several had had the same impression. The judges vote for Miss Russia, who thereby becomes Miss Universe until her dethroning 120 days later for failure to faithfully execute the duties of her office. The contest's celebrity judges are later told by parties affiliated with the pageant that Fyodorova has been dethroned because of unspecified criminal conduct by her boyfriend, Vladimir Golubev. In the 48 months following the 2002 Miss Universe pageant, Trump's fortunes in Russia changed dramatically. After 15 years of failed attempts to break into the Russian market, the Moscow market specifically, Trump finds that Russia is suddenly a critical component of the Trump Organization's investment portfolio, as Donald Trump Jr. will explain in a 2008 speech to investors at a Manhattan conference. While this is partly attributable to the fact that the push to sell units in Trump World Tower to Russians expands in 2002, when Sotheby's International Realty begins partnering with Kursanova Realty, a Russian company, another reason is that a matter of months after the Miss Universe pageant, a Russian émigré associated with the Russian criminal underworld, accompanied by his Soviet-born business partner Tefik Arif, approaches Trump about a business partnership. The émigré, Felix Sater, will for the next few years deliver a large number of Russian clients to Trump and be instrumental in finding Russian-born partners for the biggest Trump construction project of the 2000s, Trump Soho. Sater's access to the highest levels of the Russian government is made evident when, in 2006, he arranges for Ivanka Trump to sit in Putin's office chair during a tour of the Kremlin. According to Daniel Treisman, a professor of political science at UCLA and an expert on Russian politics, anyone able to get a visitor to the Kremlin into Putin's chair would have to have the highest Russian security clearances and be personally trusted by Putin. The same year, Paul Manafort moves into a 43rd floor apartment in Trump Tower, paying $3.6 million for it at a time when he is making millions working for pro-Russian politicians in Ukraine. Just a year earlier, Manafort proposed in a confidential strategy plan that he would influence politics, business dealings, and news coverage inside the United States, Europe, and former Soviet republics to benefit President Vladimir Putin's government. Manafort's proposal is eventually accepted, and he is paid $10 million in 2006 by close Putin ally Oleg Deripaska, the same year he buys his apartment in Trump Tower. Down on the 24th floor of Trump Tower, Sater and his company, the Bayrock Group, have become critical to Trump's business success, especially with Russian investors and business partners. Yet, when asked at a civil deposition in November 2013 whether he knows who Felix Sater is, Trump, under oath, says he has seen Sater only a couple of times and that he wouldn't know what Sater looks like. At a deposition 6 years earlier in 2007, Bloomberg reported that Trump had testified under oath that Sater's Bayrock brought Russian investors to his Trump Tower offices to discuss deals in Moscow, and he, Trump, was pondering investing there. "It's ridiculous that I wouldn't be investing in Russia," Trump says at the time. "Russia is one of the hottest places in the world for investment." Indeed, Trump had signed a one-year development deal with Bayrock for a Trump Tower Moscow in 2005. Though the deal fell through, a site had been selected. In 2006, Trump's partners on a real estate project in Panama go on an investor recruiting trip to Moscow. In 2007, Trump again, through Bayrock, lines up with Russian investors a deal for a Trump International hotel and tower in Moscow. According to Trump, "It would be a non-exclusive deal, so it would not have precluded me from doing other deals in Moscow, which was very important to me." After this deal falls through as well, Trump says, in the same 2007 deposition in which he speaks glowingly of Sater's real estate development company, "We're going to do another Moscow deal fairly soon. Moscow will be one of the cities where we will be." That year, Trump attends the Moscow Millionaire Fair, at which he unveils Trump Vodka for the Russian market. He also partners with Russian Alex Schneider to salvage an ailing project, Toronto's Trump International Hotel and Tower. In 2005, Forbes had written a profile on Schneider referencing his participation in the shadowy, murky, violent Ukrainian steel business, where, to get along with other steel traders and avoid death, at least 7 steel executives were assassinated in Ukraine in the 1990s, you had to hire their relatives, give them gifts, whatever could be done. Trump would claim to have a financial stake in the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Toronto, only later to admit that it was a licensing deal. Trump family members also presented inflated sales figures when the towers, in reality, stood nearly empty. In 2010, when the Toronto project falters yet again, it is rescued with nearly $1 billion in new investment by the Kremlin-owned development bank Vnesheekonombank, or VEB. In December 2016, during the presidential transition, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will meet secretly at Trump Tower with VEB's chairman, Sergei Gorkov, who graduated from the Academy of Russia's chief intelligence agency, the FSB. Observing that VEB is known for advancing the strategic interests of Russian President Vladimir Putin, the Washington Post will report that VEB called the meeting with Kushner part of a new business strategy, and that its chairman met with Kushner in his role as the head of his family's real estate business. Hope Hicks, a White House spokesperson, will insist instead that it was merely a diplomatic meeting. In 2008, Trump strikes a deal with Russian heavyweight mixed martial artist Fyodor Emelianenko, who Rolling Stone will note in May 2018 has very close ties to Vladimir Putin, for a reality show in Russia that never materializes. Trump even forms a company with Emelianenko, Affliction Entertainment, to manage and promote their joint venture. He makes his attorney, Michael Cohen, Affliction's COO. All of this explains to help how, by 2008, Donald Trump Jr., speaking to a group of investors on the topic of emerging overseas markets, could boast that Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our Trump Organization assets. He adds that the Trump Organization primarily looks for new real estate in Russia. Trump Jr.'s comments are striking for both their clarity and boldness. E-Turbo News, ETN, the global travel industry news website that reports on Trump Jr.'s address, writes that, per Trump Jr., if he were to choose his top A-list for investments in the emerging world, his firm, the Trump Organization, would choose China and Russia. ETN quotes the eldest Trump son as saying, "Given what I've seen in Russia's real estate market as of late relative to some of the emerging markets, Russia seems to have a lot more natural strength than China, especially in the high-end sector where people focus on price per square meter. In Russia, I really prefer Moscow over all cities in the world." Trump Jr. reveals to the investors that he has made 6 trips to Russia in the preceding 18 months, one trip every 90 days, and that on these trips he brings clients to the Trump Organization's projects in Moscow. His travel partners are, he says, buyers who have been attracted to our projects there. In September 2017, Trump Jr. will testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee and say that he has been to Russia only 4 or 5 times in his life. Trump Jr. does, however, note to investors in 2008 some potential obstacles for those who want to invest heavily in Russia. He explains that, based on his significant experience seeking investments in Russia, investor concerns about the Russian market are not an issue of not being able to find a deal, but can I actually trust the person I am doing the deal with? He explains that success in the Russian market is finally attributable to who knows who and whose brother is paying off who. ETN describes Trump Jr.'s depiction of Trump Organization activities in Moscow this way. Despite a current Russian government that projects a ramrod posture, to Trump, the current leaders of Russia make the scene more scary. Holding back his grin, he said, "It's so transparent, everything so interconnected that it really does not matter what is supposed to happen, as what it is they want to happen is ultimately what happens." It is unclear from ETN's coverage of the Trump Jr. speech who the "they" is that the young Trump Organization executive is referring to. Trump Jr. also discusses the Trump Organization's reliance on Russian investors investing in the United States. "We see a lot of money pouring in from Russia," he says, adding that the soon-to-be-completed Trump Soho is also specifically targeting investors in the United Arab Emirates. Trump Jr.'s boast is not an empty one. From 65 Russians buying units in a single Trump building in the late 1990s to a Bloomberg report finding that by 2004, fully one-third of units on floors 76 through 83 in Trump World Tower involved people or companies connected to Russia or neighboring states, the Trump Organization has for years counted Russian clients among its most enthusiastic customers. The New Republic describes how Trump International Beach Resort in Florida was so popular among Trump's Russian clientele that the area, Sunny Isles Beach, came to be known as Little Moscow. One of the deals Trump Jr. may be referring to in saying the Trump Organization sees a lot of money pouring in from Russia is a deal his father is working on the very summer Trump Jr. makes his claim. In November 2004, Trump had bought for $41 million a parcel of land in Florida that, despite the improvements he thereafter made to it, he couldn't unload. In 2006, it was on the market for $125 million, more than three times what Trump paid for it. By the time the Great Recession begins in the latter half of 2007, Trump has had to drop the price by 20% to around $100 million. In the summer of 2008, a Russian billionaire named Dmitry Ribolovlev offers nearly the full asking price for the property, $95 million, despite Trump's having no competing offers. Trump thereby makes $54 million in 48 months. Ribolovlev immediately destroys the structures on the property that Trump had renovated and divides the land into three parcels. By 2018, he is hoping to make a mere $18 million profit, one-third of Trump's, in over a decade of holding the land. The Charlotte Observer will note in March 2017 that Ribolovlev's plane was parked next to Trump's in Charlotte, not briefly, but for hours, 5 days before Election Day in 2016. The two men, whose planes likewise met at a Las Vegas airport 4 days prior to their second meeting in Charlotte, claim that they've never met each other. A representative for Ribolovlev declined to say whether the oligarch had been aboard the plane when it landed in Charlotte, according to the Observer. The representative also declined to say whether anyone associated with Trump was a passenger on Ribolovlev's plane, or whether its arrival was in any way connected with Trump's campaign. As the Observer concluded, if Ribolovlev were somehow assisting the campaign, it would constitute an illegal foreign donation. The same questions raised by the Trump-Ribolovlev transaction, both at the time and in the 10 days before Election Day, can likewise be asked for a number of payments Trump has received from Russian oligarchs in recent years. In March 2017, Reuters reports that just 63 Russians have invested a total of nearly $100 million in Trump's Florida properties, adding, "The tally of investors from Russia may be conservative. The analysis found that at least 703, or about one-third, of the owners of the 2,044 units in the seven Trump buildings are limited liability companies, or LLCs, which have the ability to hide the identity of a property's true owner. And the nationality of many other buyers could not be determined." Russian Americans who did not use a Russian address or passport in their purchases were not included in the tally. The influence Putin wields over his billionaire acolytes is such that if he wanted to turn off the spigot of their money flooding to Trump Organization properties in America, he could do so, and quickly. Says Thomas Graham, co-director of the Russian Studies program at Yale University, if you're a Russian oligarch, you can lose your property overnight if you run afoul of the government. In 2010, Trump Soho is sued for deceptive sales practices. The building is partly financed by Soviet-born Alexander Mashkievich, an Israeli citizen who owns homes in Belgium and London. Mashkievich has been accused at various points, writes Bloomberg, of laundering a $55 million bribe by purchasing property outside Brussels. The case has since been settled for an undisclosed fine and no admission of fault, paying hundreds of millions of dollars in potential bribes to acquire mines in Africa, and corruption in Kazakhstan. The investigation of Trump Soho involves two of Trump's children, Don Jr. and Ivanka, and mirrors the investigation of the Trump Tower in Toronto a year earlier, with the new claims contending the Trumps made misleading statements as to what percentage of the units had been sold. The Trump family's candor is called into question again in 2014 when Eric Trump tells a reporter for Golf magazine, James Dodson, that the Trumps' golf courses are all financed by Russian banks and that the Trump Organization has all the money we need from Russia. Dodson will report the quote in 2017 after Trump's election. Eric will contend that Dodson completely fabricated it. In the 2010s, the New York Police Department arrests 29 people suspected of having connections to a Russian money laundering scheme headquartered in a Trump Tower condo right below one owned by Trump himself. The alleged ringleader of the scheme is notorious Russian organized crime boss Semyon Mogilevich, a man who has repeatedly been on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. In the decade's early years, Trump pursues numerous projects in the former Soviet republics, including a deal announced in 2011 to build Trump Tower Batumi in Georgia, a 2012 signed contract to build Trump International Hotel and Tower Baku in Azerbaijan, and a failed bid to build an obelisk-shaped tower near the presidential palace in Astana, Kazakhstan. As McClatchy writes in June 2017, Trump dreamed of his name on towers across the former Soviet Union. Craig Unger, a former editor for both the New York Observer and Boston Magazine, argues in his book, House of Trump, House of Putin, that based on his own research and additional investigation by a former federal prosecutor, Trump was, through Felix Sater's Bayrock Group, indirectly providing Putin with a regular flow of intelligence on what the Russian oligarchs were doing with their money in the United States. Unger's research suggests Putin wanted to keep tabs on the Russian billionaires, some of them former mobsters, who had made their post-Cold War fortunes on the backs of industries once owned by the state. The oligarchs were stashing their money beyond Putin's reach. Trump, knowingly or otherwise, may have struck a side deal with the Kremlin, secretly ratting out his customers to Putin, who would allow them to keep buying Trump properties. On January 11, 2017, just 9 days before his inauguration as President of the United States, Trump will tweet the following. Russia has never tried to use leverage over me. I have nothing to do with Russia. No deals, no loans, no nothing. Annotated History. Trump's trip to Moscow in 1987 comes at the invitation of Russia's ambassador to the United States, Yuri Dubinin. In Moscow, he stays in the Lenin suite of the Hotel National, which, as Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine notes, certainly would have been bugged in 1987. Trump holds meetings on the possible construction of a Trump hotel with Soviet officials, coming away from the meetings certain that the officials are eager to do business with him. In March 2018, The New York Times reported that Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election has expanded to include President Trump's family business, with the special counsel subpoenaing the Trump Organization for documents related to Russia. For more than 30 years, Mr. Trump has repeatedly sought to conduct business in Russia, the Times wrote, adding, "His children and associates have met with Russian developers and government officials on multiple occasions in search of joint ventures." By 1997, though no construction has begun on Trump's hoped-for Moscow projects, The New Yorker is writing of the breadth of Trump's hopes for Moscow investment and business connections. Trump's plans for the expansion of his real estate portfolio into Russia go well beyond a single Trump International Hotel. Trump envisions a much larger series of investments. He tells The New Yorker, "It would be skyscrapers and hotels. We're working with the local government, the mayor of Moscow, and the mayor's people. So far, they've been very responsive." The Washington Post quotes America's then ambassador to Russia, John Byerly, as saying of Moscow's then mayor, Yuri Lushkov, "Corruption in Moscow remains pervasive, with Mayor Lushkov at the top of the pyramid. Lushkov oversees a system in which it appears that almost everyone at every level is involved in some form of corruption or criminal behavior." Russia begins a period of political upheaval that sees the nation led by five successive prime ministers appointed by Boris Yeltsin over a 15-month period in 1998 and 1999. The last of these prime ministers is a man by the name of Vladimir Putin. Trump's answers on whether he has ever spoken to or developed a relationship with Vladimir Putin in the 2000s or any time after run the gamut. The closest he came to contradicting Putin's claim that the two men never spoke before, during, or in the immediate aftermath of the 2002 Miss Universe pageant was in a 2015 interview with radio personality Michael Savage, well before Trump's relationship with Russian nationals had become controversial. Trump told Savage in response to a question asking whether he'd ever met Putin, "Yes. One time, yes. Long time ago. Got along with him great, by the way." Trump did not specify how long before 2015 he met Putin. At various points, Trump has said he knows Putin, while at other times he has denied it. According to a July 2017 Associated Press report, ever since the Russia investigation began, Trump has categorically denied having ever met Putin. At a July 2016 press conference, Trump said, "I never met Putin. I don't know who Putin is. I never met Putin. Never spoken to him. I don't know anything about him." Shortly thereafter, Trump told ABC's George Stephanopoulos, "I have no relationship with Putin. I've never met him." Pressed by Stephanopoulos on his prior statements to the contrary, Trump said, "I have no relationship with Putin. I don't think I've ever met him. I never met him. I don't think I've ever met him. I don't think I've ever met him. I mean, if he's in the same room or something, but I don't think so. I don't have a relationship with him. I didn't meet him. I haven't spent time with him. I didn't have dinner with him. I wouldn't know him from Adam, except I see his picture and I would know what he looks like." Even Trump's pre-campaign statements about meeting and knowing Putin exhibit an unusual evasiveness for a man known to brag about inconsequential encounters with famous people. In November 2015, Time described an incident in which Trump said, "I got to know Putin very well because we were stablemates on the television program 60 Minutes. In fact, the two men had appeared via satellite from different continents and had never spoken. As noted by the Associated Press in its compilation of Trump's contradictory statements about his relationship with Putin, in a 2013 NBC News interview, Trump said, twice in fact, "I do have a relationship with Putin." In October of that year, he said to talk show host David Letterman of Putin, "He's a tough guy. I met him once," implying the two men had met prior to 2013. After his alleged speakerphone conversation with Putin on November 9, 2013, see Chapter 2, but before his relationship with the Russian leader had become controversial, Trump maintained his claim to have had contact with Putin in the past, while adding a new wrinkle. I spoke indirectly and directly with President Putin during the 2013 Miss Universe pageant, he told the National Press Club in May 2014, and he could not have been nicer. It is unclear what speaking with someone indirectly could mean. Certainly a speakerphone conversation is one possibility. Notable across all of these statements is that not only does Trump insist he has met Putin, but that the two men have established enough of a connection for it to be characterized, "I can tell you that he's very interested in what we're doing here today," Trump said in his 2013 NBC News interview at the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow. "Putin couldn't have been nicer to me," he said the next year. "Got along with him great," he said the year after that. On November 2, 2017, an eyewitness to the judging process at the 2002 Miss Universe contest will contact this author to say that the contest was rigged. Trump has enormous influence over which Miss Universe contestants will advance at the annual pageant. In 2009, TMZ secured an audio recording of Trump that revealed the pageant had since 1996 operated under the Trump rule, pursuant to which Trump himself got to choose the pageant's semifinalists. On the recording, Trump can be heard saying, "We get to choose a certain number of contestants who will be guaranteed to make it through the first round. You know why we do that? Because years ago when I first bought it, in 1996, we chose 10 people. I chose none, and I get here, and the most beautiful people were not chosen, and I went nuts. So we call it the Trump rule." In September 2009, the New York Daily News called the pageant's annual winners hand-picked by Trump, quoting the pageant's then choreographer, who said that Donald Trump hand-picks 6 of the 15 finalists in the pageant, and that he does so single-handedly. In March 2018, Newsweek reported that Trump applied the Trump rule with two considerations: whether a contestant was too ethnic, meaning whether her skin tone strayed too far from white, and whether she had snubbed his sexual advances. The magazine cited multiple pageant staffers. The accounts of these whistleblowers erase any confusion about whether Trump was joking when, as reported by Rolling Stone, he said on the Howard Stern show in 2009 that he couldn't say if he'd ever slept with any contestants because it would be a conflict of interest, adding, "But you know, it's the kind of thing you worry about later. You tend to think about the conflict a little bit later on." He finished the thought by arguing that a pageant owner in fact has an obligation to sleep with contestants. The judges vote for Miss Russia, who thereby becomes Miss Universe, until her dethroning 120 days later for failure to faithfully execute the duties of her office. Trump's most extensive comments on Oksana Fyodorova's dethroning, which came in New York on the day Fyodorova was replaced by Justine Pasek of Panama, saw him admit that his organization had conducted an investigation to determine if Fyodorova was secretly married to Golubev. The notoriously spiteful Trump, who Miss Universe 1996 Alicia Machado said repeatedly called her fat and ugly and was scary to her, according to a September 2016 Washington Post report, was unusually gracious as he dethroned a Miss Universe for the first time in 2002. "We worked hard with Oksana," he said of the object of Putin's fascination, according to a September 2002 report by the Sydney Morning Herald. "But a lot of these events are for charity, and you just have to be there. She wasn't able to be there, so we had no choice but to terminate." Trump added, surprisingly, given his public penchant for firing contestants in his competitions, that he gave Fyodorova a chance to resign so that everything could be done nicely, but she refused, though he added that she graciously returned her tiara. Besides Trump going out of his way to note that Fyodorova was a very nice person, perhaps Trump's most unusual comment regarding Fyodorova was his reference to her home country during the press conference. "Was she homesick?" the Herald reports Trump asking rhetorically. "Well, she certainly enjoyed being in Russia," he said, adding quickly that he had great respect for Russia as a country. Sater's access to the highest levels of the Russian government is made evident when in 2006 he arranges for Ivanka Trump to sit in Putin's office chair during a tour of the Kremlin. According to Daniel Treisman, a professor of political science at UCLA and an expert on Russian politics, anyone able to get a visitor to the Kremlin into Putin's chair would have to have the highest Russian security clearances